Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
By the time Divisional Detective Inspector Burt arrived at 66 Old Compton Street, constables were holding back a gaggle of eager gawpers. As reporters feverishly quoted any pleb who said they had seen or heard something sinister. As some reporters even snuck into the Swiss Hotel opposite to try and spy the corpse through the second floor window. 6 months earlier, a dead Soho prostitute barely filled a few lines. But now the murders were front page news in many local, national, and by the next day, even international papers, as once again, Soho became infamous as a den of sex, drugs, and death. The crime scene was eerily reminiscent, but as with the others, it was assessed methodically. Again, there were no signs of a prior break-in, as both sash windows were shut. The neighbouring flats were inaccessible, with the only tenants being two floors below, who had slept soundly until the arrival of the police. And the doors to the flat and the street had been locked by whoever had taken her key. Inside, the room was dimly lit, as the sunlight pierced the partially open curtains. But again, with the gas lights set to on and the shilling expired, only in death was the room plunged into near darkness. This bed-sitting room was small, comprising of a wardrobe and a dresser which hadn't been ransacked, a settee on which the victim's coat still lay. Under the bed sat three half-full, untouched suitcases, as the tenants had only just moved in. And on the mantelpiece, an open handbag gave the illusion of a robbery. Leia's body lay diagonally across the bed, having prepared herself for sex with a punter. She was wearing shoes, with her stockings neatly rolled down to the ankles, and her blue spotted dress rucked up to her waist, as she lay with her legs widely spread. Under the wardrobe, a pair of ladies' knickers were found. They were wet and dirty, although who removed them and when is uncertain. As before, with no evidence of natural death nor obvious sexual assault, although the cotton wool balls inside her vagina were soiled and foul-smelling, no recent sexual intercourse had taken place. Either trusting her assailant or never sensing any threat, she had died in the position her injuries were inflicted, as her body had barely moved during the assault and there were no defensive wounds. Her injuries showed a logical order, as if inflicted by someone who could kill with both speed and silence. A large bruise to her lower left jaw may have rendered her semi-conscious. Abrasions to the neck and a fractured larynx suggested that the throat had been gripped by an assailant's hand. But as if he lacked the strength to finish it, again, he grabbed a ligature. Not a stocking, but a black electrical flex, wound around her neck, looped and held, as he slowly throttled her, staring at her terrified eyes. Barely breathing, and with her left pupil blown, phlegm and vomit in the airway confirmed she was still alive when he strangled her. Although a mystery remains why he did knot it to ensure her death. Was this a mistake? Had he developed a sadistic streak? Or was her death personal? Lying on a pink bedsheet, as if to hide from himself the horrors he would unleash, it was pulled over her head, covering her face. And with her nose and mouth peeping through the rip, he grabbed a 1 kilo flat iron from the dresser, raised it high, and brought it hard down upon her face and her head. The skull was broken into depressed fragments. The fractures extended to the base of the skull and to the roofs of the ocular orbits, and the exposed brain matter was deeply lacerated and pulped. With blood in her airways, she was still alive as her head was caved in. Pear-drop-shaped blood spatter had spread across the walls, the floor, the ceiling and the door. And the mattress was so saturated, blood had penetrated through the bed, which had oozed through the bedclothes and onto the suitcases below. Constance May Hind, alias Dutch Leia, had died between 12:30 a.m. and 3 a.m. With no witnesses, no clues to her killer's identity, the electrical flex of no known origin or owner, and fingerprints found which matched Leia, Stanley, the landlord, the last tenants, and innumerable unidentified clients. Dr. Charles Burney and Sir Bernard Spilsbury unanimously confirmed that Leia had been murdered. But by who? Several suspects were ruled out of the investigation. Robert Smith, Leia's husband, who hadn't seen her since she had left him, was seen by several witnesses in the seaside town of Margate. Her mother Kathleen, a known fraudster, stayed the whole night at a friend's house on Percy Street. Gordon Bodley, her wayward father, was tracked down but wasn't in London that week. And her ex-lovers and known ponces, Jim Rich, William Billy Sullivan and George Day, were all in prison at the time of the murder. The last sightings of Leia herald a few likely suspects. Leia Cohen saw her at 10:50 p.m. on Old Compton Street and stated she was scared of a man. He was jealous as she was living with someone else. But when investigated, this turned out to be Billy Sullivan. Ruby Walker stated, "At 11:30 p.m, I met Leia on the corner of Old Compton Street. A Greek came up and tried to get off with her. Only she rejected him as they had previously had a dispute over money." Being local, he was later identified and ruled out. at 12:30 a.m. Emilio Plantino, hall porter at the London Casino on Old Compton Street. Saw Leia proceeding on the south side of the street with a man. Described as 30 years old, 5'7" tall, fair complexion, brown brushback hair, slim build, in a dark raincoat and no hat. Confirmed by Nellie Few. She saw Leia enter 66 Old Compton Street with a man. And her description is close to Emilio's. Aged about 25, 5'5" tall, medium build, fresh complexion, brown hair, clean shaven, a long black coat and no hat. Described as reliable witnesses, both Nellie and Emilio were shown photos of known persons of interest by the police, including any potential suspects, but they failed to identify the person they had seen. For the detectives, whoever is responsible for the murder undoubtedly accompanied the prostitute to her room, ostensibly for the purposes of sexual intercourse. This theory is supported by the position of the body. It is also reasonable to assume that the robbery was the motive, as a handbag was found open and no money in the room. It is also very improbable that she would have consented to prepare herself for sexual intercourse without first receiving payment, which was a logical theory. Careful consideration has been given to the possibility of the murder being one of revenge on the part of a Ponce. But if such were the case, one would have expected to find evidence of a row or disorder. Assuming the assailant would have had prior convictions, the police commissioner requested all local and county divisions to investigate anyone with a history of violence against women and/or prostitutes, who also resembled the suspect. With 103 men later questioned, they all had alibis. Some weren't in London, many were in prison, and when visually compared, most of the men did not match the suspect. But which suspect? Stanley King was the most logical suspect. A jealous boyfriend with a tenuous alibi and timings which could not be categorically verified by others. But with the evidence against him being circumstantial, the police report states, the deceased was last seen alive entering 66 Old Compton Street with a man who in all probability was responsible for her death. It is possible she met a further man, but despite exhaustive inquiries of those known to frequent the area, no one saw her after this time. Once again, a Soho prostitute had been strangled in her own bed by an unknown assailant. And having questioned hundreds of witnesses and suspects, for a third time, the investigation hit a brick wall. The police report would conclude, it is most unfortunate that we have to admit defeat in our investigation into this case. Following so quickly on from the undetected murders of Josephine Martin and Jean-Marie Cousins. There is nothing to show, however, that there is a connection between any of these cases. Despite the most exhaustive inquiries, no evidence could be found on which even suspicion could be attached to any known person. And it is unlikely that these crimes will ever be solved. On Tuesday the 9th of June 1936, coinciding with the delayed inquest of Jean-Marie Cotton. The death of Constance May Hind was concluded at Westminster Coroner's Court. With witnesses called, evidence examined, and suspects questioned. Although Leah's mother and uncle openly blamed her boyfriend, nothing concrete could prove that Stanley King had anything to do with the murder of Dutch Leah. Wrapped up the same day, the coroner, Mr. Ingleby Oddy, would state of both women's deaths, "There is no doubt that she has been murdered by persons or persons unknown," as he had with French Fifi. Again, another murder had gone unsolved. With the inquest concluded and the case closed, no further details would furnish the newspaper's front pages, as the press feverishly tried to piece together the clues as to which lone killer had strangled three women in a spree across Soho's red light district. The murders of Fifi, Marie, and Leah would easily have been forgotten. But with the killer described by the coroner as a homicidal maniac, as if recalling the terrifying days of Jack the Ripper, that was all that was needed to fan the flames of conspiracy, suspicion, and panic. The Daily Mirror went with, "Soho is scared. A fourth woman strangled in a Soho flat." Which was untrue, and it left the police trying to quell the public's fears. The Sunday Pictorial headlined with, "Dutch Leah feared murder. She always prophesied that she would not die a natural death." And although this did not appear in any statement, it ran rampant as a fact. The Mirror ran with, "Maniacs three Soho women victims. Girls' friends fear to talk." Stating, "It may be our turn next." Even though not a single sex worker questioned, spoke of being afraid. And some articles, such as Every Week, even created their own facts, as if the case wasn't salacious enough. Stating of Dutch Leah, "The woman's tongue was badly mutilated. This deliberate mutilation is a serious warning to Soho. This woman talked too much. Take heed, lest you get the same dose." It was all lies. But if you print it, it becomes fact. And the more you repeat it, it becomes proof. Throughout, the press repeatedly made reference to a strangler in Soho, a strangler gang, and even Soho's serial strangler. But it wasn't until the 23rd of May 1936, 2 weeks after Leah's death, that in connection to a fourth alleged strangling of a Soho prostitute called Dorothy Raphael, for whom no police or incident record exists, the Evening Dispatch would first use the words, "The Soho Strangler." And the name stuck. Like the unknown maniac who once stalked Whitechapel, Soho's very own killer was given a name. But by mythologizing a man and making him into a monster, again the victims would be forgotten. Everybody loves a villain, and Jack the Ripper is possibly the most infamous. Almost 140 years since his killing spree, Jack has morphed from a mere man with either mental health issues or a maniacal bent, into a monster with godlike status, who outwitted the police with his cunning, who had a surgeon's skill, who as a moral guardian cleaned up the city of disease-rattled whores, who was possibly a genius painter, and who evaded capture as he had friends in high places, as high up as the Queen. It makes for a fascinating tale, but lacking any credible evidence, it's most probably bollocks. The truth is, Jack the Ripper attacked lone, hungry, vulnerable women in the dark, and then he fled. In short, he was a coward. But no one buys books about cowards, and it's even harder to worship a weakling. The same is true of most serial killers. We know their names, but rarely their victims. Disregarded as mere props for his pleasure, or pieces of meat simply to be hacked to bits. The way we make a monster more palatable for a moral eye is by dismissing the victims until all that remains of them is their name, age, and injuries. Examine any newspaper about the murder of Constance May Hind, and the same formula is repeated. The first paragraph is an overview of the crime. The subtext of the second paragraph is why it is acceptable that she was murdered. And the third paragraph and beyond is the mythology of the killer. As their only source of information, not all of which was true, the public were informed not to mourn her passing, as her murder was clearly preceded by her own life choices and moral transgressions. Leia was an outsider, as along with Fifi and Marie, she was described as living a bohemian lifestyle, with never an example to prove this, just that she was living among undesirables. Next up to be critiqued was her name, her many aliases, like Leia Smith, Leia Hines, Constance May Hind, and May Constance Smith, to name but a few. Most of which were legitimate, but whiffed of criminality, and with the repeated use of her street name of Dutch Leia, this was there to remind us that she was a prostitute. Often, the headlines heralded her as a young, pretty brunette, as if it was her fault that her looks had led a killer to take her life. And yet, had she been fat, old, and ugly, the implication is he wouldn't have bothered. As with Fifi and Marie, many articles reference that they were French, but also Russian and Jewish, with it all written in bold capital letters to play on this post-World War I xenophobia even further. And even though she was English-born and bred, many state Leia Hines is of German extraction. Never once would they mention her tough upbringing, only her dubious life and her criminal record. So when this dead girl was found sprawled on her bed, with her body described as partially clothed, in a state of undress, and just in her underwear, the fault was not laid at her killer, but at her. Basically, the prostitute known as Dutch Leia was someone we should never mourn. In the eyes of the readers, she died cruelly because of the world she inhabited. Soho, a sinister place of foreigners, a seedy cesspit of vice, a plague of undesirables, and a den of the criminal underworld. As with Whitechapel in the 1880s, Soho in the 1930s reflected our socio-political anxieties, and the Soho Strangler embodied the public's fears. By 1936, still reeling from the First World War, with Hitler violating the Treaty of Versailles by remilitarizing the Rhineland, Mussolini invading Abyssinia, and Nazi Germany and Fascist Italy forming the Rome-Berlin Axis, a Second World War was already being mooted. With talk of communists, fascists, Nazis, and swarms of aliens upon our shores. Just as Jack the Ripper was a villain who embodied their fears, the Soho Strangler reflected ours. A society blamed the usual band of undesirables, such as foreigners, gays, Jews, bohemians, the insane, and the disabled. In all likelihood, the Soho Strangler was merely a man. But being afraid that this man was one of us, the press made him a monster who was one of them. The police's prime suspect in the murder of Dutch Leah was the man seen with her by Emilio Plantino and Nellie Few. Their combined statements describe him as aged 25 to 30, 5 foot 5 to 5 foot 7 inches high, slim to medium build, fresh complexion, clean shaven, brown brushback hair, a long black coat and no hat. That could be her killer. The problem is, it matches the average male in the 1930s. As descriptions go, it's ordinary and unremarkable. But when readers slather over a blood-splattered story about a homicidal maniac, they don't want the killer to be just a man. They want a monster. It took the tinkering of hundreds of tiny details to transform the Soho Strangler from a possible punter last seen walking along Old Compton Street with Leia, to become a predatory serial killer of Soho sex workers, who baffled Scotland Yard and strikes with an insane but deadly cunning. To many, the changes were barely noticeable. The Liverpool Echo wrote, "He is believed to be an artist or a foreigner. This is unknown, but it fits with the idea that a bohemian would kill his own kind." And more bizarrely, the Daily Herald stated, "He was coloured or Greek," which neither witness said. Within the day, other newspapers had adapted the same description, as issued by the police, but with a few subtle changes to make this man more monstrous. Suddenly, he had long hair, a thin face, a dark grey cap, and with hair growing out of the nape of his neck. As he walks with a slouch, this deformed beast would stalk Soho with an ape-like gait. It took almost no time to make him real but fictional. One of them, but not one of us. This was emphasized even further, as with the killer prowling known haunts, as the press would call them, it was almost as if he was a ghoul opposed to a guy. And stating, "Police were searching all lodging houses and second-class boarding houses," it was clear that the killer should never be middle or upper class, but utter scum. And with the constant repetition of how he vanished, rather than fled. How he disappeared rather than ran away like a coward. And how he evaded capture rather than walked into a busy street which was full of strangers minding their own business. Even his movements became mythic. Keen to play on the recurring theme, which had embedded into local and national papers in the years before the Soho Strangler killings, the Sunday Dispatch and the Daily Independent exclaimed that the case would be cracked, as detectives were convinced that there is a crime king in Soho who knows all the secrets and the culprits. With all three murders, French Fifi, Marie Cotton, and Dutch Leia, linked without question, it was said that all three women had connections to the white slave trade. It all began with Josephine Martin, alias French Fifi, found dead in her Archer Street flat, strangled with one of her own silk stockings, who was said to have acted at various times as an agent for white slave traders and for peddlers of coke. Which the Sunday Pictorial confirmed to its eager readership, hungry for new facts and ever more thrilling stories. It is believed by Scotland Yard to be a vendetta, which has already claimed three lives in a reign of terror against Soho's underworld. On the 12th of May 1936, the Evening Dispatch used the headline "Soho Strangler Gang," implying an extortion racket in the West End, where women were forced into marriages of convenience and shipped in and out of London or Paris to work as prostitutes to pay off an impossible bill to their pimps or poncers. With no evidence to link any of the murders to a criminal gang, a lone killer, or even their most likely suspects, the murders of French Fifi, Marie Cotton and Dutch Leia were reluctantly closed. As the national and international press drooled over three unsolved murders, an incompetent police force, a city suburb in terror, and a killer with a very quotable nickname. Just like the media sensation 50 years earlier, which was Jack the Ripper, they bayed for more blood, and with it, more murders. But with an odd eerie silence descending over Soho, although they still spoke of panic gripping Soho, another girl found dead, and most bizarrely, the Soho Strangler caught. As the killing stopped, so did the reader's attention. And with the press looking elsewhere for news, the Soho Strangler was forgotten. On the 13th of September 1936, Every Week posted a full-page article, syndicated across the world, which read, "The Soho Strangler Who Baffled Scotland Yard." It filled the space, but by the next day, it was being used as chip paper. In the late 1940s, the press dangled the same carrot about the Soho Strangler striking again, as four more prostitutes were murdered, all within streets of each other. Ginger Ray, Russian Dora, Margaret Cook and Black Rita. But this time, the public didn't bite. The case may never be solved, as with the police having exhausted every avenue of investigation, and the press having manipulated the sightings of the suspect to such an extent that every witness after its publication gave an identically false story, including Stanley King. The mythologizing of the monster and the demonizing of his victims has turned three murders into nothing but a gory story for the sake of our entertainment. More than 80 years on, the truth about the Soho Strangler may be lost forever. And yet, the press did leave us a very real suspect. A Jew, known only as Mr. Cohen. Part 7 of 10 of The Soho Strangler continues next week.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Got that line. There we go. Oh, let's see. Did that? Not too bad. Not terrible. Not terrible. Not terrible. Oh, let's hope it all recorded nicely. Oh, and a weird little recording. Then suddenly had a major downpour of rain for no reason. And then a man outside who was walking along decided, I know, I'll just stand outside Mike's boat underneath the tree and start singing a bloody song. Utter, utter bastard. I'm just taking your hat off. That's why it sounds weird. Oh, I hope this is recording okay. It looks like it was. Oh, it's always hard. You look at the waveform afterwards and you think, it looks like it's recorded fine. But then you're kind of just like, you won't know until you start listening to it. Right. Oh. Anyway, welcome to Estramile. I totally forgotten to write that little piece of text at the end. Part 7 of The Soho Strangler continues next week. I totally forgot to write that in. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed that. Ooh, very exciting. Very exciting. Things are hotting up now. People who are kind of Walk With Me subscribers on Patreon will know all this. The fact that the story starts very slowly and subtly, and it's all kind of like, as with Jack the Ripper, do you know, the murders at the start were kind of unconnected, and then everybody starts getting excited, and then it picks up, and you have the double murderer event, and then you have the Dear Boss letter, and it's all very exciting, and everyone gets really excited, and it all goes around the world, and ooh, Jack the Ripper. And then the kind of murders, it gets to a point where the murders stop, and people start connecting things that aren't connected, and the press are panicking because they're making a lot of money out of this. Jack the Ripper is wonderful for them. They make a lot of money. Their circulation skyrockets. They're making a fortune. They're like, oh my God, we need more information, which is why they lie so often, because they need more information. You need to fill those pages. You got like 36 pages to fill every single day. That's thousands of words you need to find. And if you fill it full of crap that's that people don't find interesting, then they're not going to buy it. Whereas if you fill it with something sensational, even if it's shit, even if it's lies, it works, because people will buy it. And let's not forget, you buy your newspaper today, you read it, you go tell your friends about it, the next day you've forgotten. Oh, so yeah. Oh, cripes. Let's pop on a cup of tea, which I probably won't drink, but hey ho, there we go. Let's pop this on. I've already prepped this. Oh, all good. Still currently waiting for my passport. Oh, it took ages. Really annoying. I had to because I'm technically itinerant. Don't really like that title, but because I don't have a home address, I'm classified as itinerant. So even though the passport office would accept that my PO box is where all of my paperwork goes to, all of my bank stuff, all of my tax stuff, all of my NHS stuff, everything to do with the government department, they accepted that. They said, we can't send the passport there. Utter shitbags. And they wouldn't send it to the passport office for me to collect, so I had to get a mate to do it. And the delivery company, who shall not be named, was meant to deliver it today. They sent a photo of the outside of the door. I don't think they rang the doorbell, because my mate, who was waiting to receive it, he was like, I didn't hear it ring, and he was next to the effing doorbell. They're such wankers, they really are. So I'm going to have to get in a taxi and go all the way out to their depot and maybe have a scream at them. Luckily, I'm off to the pub very soon. Go to the pub with a mate very shortly. Then I'm off to see Mr. Johnny Books of Cult No Name, because it's his wife's birthday tonight. So there'll be some drinking going on, which is all very good. What else is going on? Patron subscribers. Finally, after the cyber attack, the Royal Mail is now accepting post going overseas. So many of them have been sitting here for a month. They've been sitting here for so long that by the time I got to the post office, the paperwork had changed. They'd created new paperwork, so I had to sit there, and like I'd been really good. I was really proud because I was there with all the parcels, and I was like, don't worry, I've done all the customs forms, everything's done. And they went, no, it's the wrong customs forms now. It's like, for fuck's sake. So, oh dear. Anyway, I tell you what, let's do the questions while my tea is brewing. Question number one: who was the first detective to arrive on the scene of Leia's murder? Ooh, can you remember that? That was the first line in the episode. Cool, blimey. Question number two: what was under Leia's wardrobe? I think a boat was going past now, and it's gunning it like a twat. My boat will shake. Get ready. Blue boat with red flashing on it. Utter twat. Ooh, fucking hell. What the fuck was that? Something just hit the roof. Let's hope glad it didn't smash a window. Right, question number three. What colour... Let me just have a look outside the window and make sure something isn't against my window. No, just sounds like it's something fell on the roof. Question number three. What colour was Leia's bedspread? There you go. Did I do question number two? What was under Leia's wardrobe? Question number three, what colour was Leia's bedspread? Question number four, what weight was the flat iron? Question number five, where was the inquest into Leia and Marie's murders held? Question number six, who oversaw the inquest? Question number seven, who did the press say was the fourth victim of the Soho Strangler? Question number eight. Who was the last witnesses to see Leia alive? Question number nine. Name one of the four victims of the supposed return of the Soho Strangler in the 1940s. And question number ten. What is the name of the press's very possible suspect? Oh, this is exciting, isn't it? Did you think that person was going to come back into this story? Did you not? Oh, see, things are hotting up now. This is why I think if some people are binging this, you're not going to get it, really. Because it's a 10-parter, but it takes... Already people who are listening to it are already listening to each episode multiple times, because there's a lot in there, and there's a lot of tiny pieces that link to all the later episodes. So if you binge it in one go, you're going to blurb and your brain's just going to fry. It's going to pop and fizz, and you're going to be collapsed on the floor going, "What happened? What happened?" Whereas if you... Take your time with this. Really, listen to an episode, let it sink into your head, because it's the bits and pieces that are really important. And this is where it all starts coming together, and it all gets messy, and it all something from episode one comes back to episode six, as has just happened, and episode two, in episode nine, and it's all linked. All the little details are there, so get ready. A little hello to Police Constable Arsenal Guinness, who I met up for beers during the week. And that was my birthday treat, was to see Police Constable Arsenal Guinness. And it was lovely to see you, mate. We had some good beers. Good beers and good times. I think I've done this. Let's put my tea in it. Why am I doing this? I'm probably not even going to drink the tea. It's like I get through this, and then I do some charging up of shit. I don't think I'm going to go to Starbucks today, because I'm meeting a mate at 4:30. 4:30 on a Saturday to go boozing. Brilliant. It's what Jesus would have wanted. So yeah, that was good. Lovely to see Police Constable Arsenal Guinness. He was on fine fettle, and we talked about a lot of important things. So that's that done. Let's dive into some extra stuff. What I've decided to do with this, because this, it's taken me technically months, but really years, to piece all this information together, because it's not out there, and what is out there is shit. So it's been a real labour of love trying to piece all this together and make it consistent and tie together all the threads, and there's a lot of loose threads out there. So even though we've got extra mile, I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to do a Soho Strangler week afterwards, and what I'm going to do is individually go through different pieces. It won't be like a regular Murder Mile episode. It'll be more like an extra mile. Or what I did with the Thames Towpath murders. And what I'll do is I'll go through each bit individually. We'll go through witness statements. You know, it will give me an opportunity to read them all, and it will help if you want to kind of solve who the Soho Strangler is. Not to say it hasn't been solved. That will, this is kind of extra stuff that's in there, so it could be quite interesting. So, yeah, there's a lot to unravel with this. So let's dive into the crime scene. What was there? Crime scene, very similar to the other rooms. Front bed, sitting room, second floor, accessed by the street door. I did a lot of kind of research into the house itself, because there is a kind of, as with Marie Cotton's house and as with French Fifi's, there's a little courtyard out back. But the courtyards, and especially in Soho areas, they don't have... Some of them have like a street door on the out leading to the courtway, but a lot of them don't. It's kind of buildings built together, and there's a bit of an open space which people use for just shit, really. Just storing shit. So this one has one as well. And even though it backs onto Bouchier Street, which is where Captain Ritchie was bricked over the head with... a brick, and the killing of Baby Richard. Even though that's immediately at the back opposite, you can't get access to it. You certainly couldn't then. So there was no way for any potential murderer in that house to have escaped. Even at the back, there's windows, but they overlook. He could have dropped down, but then he would have gone into the courtyard. And how do you get out of that? He could have jumped out the front window on the front onto Old Compton Street, but again, what's the point of that? It's a busy street, it's overlooked by the Swiss Hotel, which is now known as Compton's, and the place immediately opposite, which is where the 21 Club is. So it's a busy street. It's like, you know, why would you do that? Why not just casually walk? If you go into Soho and you visit any of the places, or you walk past any of these walk-ups, which are the brothels, and you'll see a sign outside that says
models, and that means it's a brothel, because you're not allowed to say brothel, you have to say models, and everyone goes, oh, it must be models up there, I wonder if I see Kate Moss or Claudia Schiffer. Obviously not, it's prostitutes. But if you stand outside there any time, you'll see guys walking in and out all the time. I used to work on Frith Street for years, and you'd see guys going in and out of the brothels at lunchtime. They'd go out, they'd have a sandwich, they'd have a coffee, then they'd go and visit a prostitute, and then they'd go back to work. Always fascinating to watch, always really fascinating. But yeah, so that is the way in and out. As we've seen with other cases before, with the deaf-mute murderer, many prostitutes have maids. We saw it with French Fifi, she had a maid. Marie Cotton isn't a prostitute, but Dorothy Neary, who was the prostitute who lived in the front floor flat, who she may have been mistaken for, as mentioned in an earlier episode, she didn't have a maid either, and neither did Dutch Lair. So normally the maid would kind of open the door, the street door outside, or the street door would be left open so people can come in and out, but then they'd have to knock on the flat door and then be greeted by the maid or the prostitute themselves. In this case, it was a street door that was left open most of the day until the seamstress, who was on the first floor, or the guys who were living in the basement. They were the only other tenants who were there at that point because the top floor was unusable. Well, it says uninhabited, but I've seen some references to it being unusable. The building is described as dilapidated. So it would only be closed normally after the seamstress had left. Same as with Marie Cotton as well, because Mr. Gibelli, the Italian tailor on the top floor, he would leave after himself and then he would lock the street door, but that's the only time it would be locked. So that is the only entrance or exit to the building. Obviously there's no signs of disorder in there. Again, none of the drawers have been kind of rifled through. The cupboards aren't open. Have a look at the Blackout Ripper series. You can see when he's in there, he's clearly someone who's he's a sexual sadist. I think we've already gone into the details of what he could potentially be. Whether he was a sadomasochist, whether he was just clawing for attention, I think that's part of it. But when you look at the room, he's very much going around. He's stealing stuff that he wants on top of doing his sexual assault and his violent assault and, you know, all the things like that. Here it's not. Here it very much isn't. There's no disorder to the room. Drawers aren't open. Cupboards aren't emptied. Suitcases underneath the bed haven't been touched. She doesn't have a lot of personal effects in the room, because let's not forget she is transient. She does seem to move every 2 or 3, 4 weeks into different places. So the likelihood is she probably doesn't take her personal stuff out of her bag. Also because it's a room where she invites strangers in, it's likely to get nicked, isn't it, if she's not paying attention, so she probably doesn't do that. In her room was her handbag, which was on the mantelpiece. Inside, the police found 2 pennies and a small envelope, as is used for containing, here's my favourite word, rubber sheaths. Sheaths. Also known as French letters, as we would call condoms. It doesn't say how many condoms were in there. The condoms were potentially supplied by Sidney Bloom, who we introduced to in episode 1. But then again, he supplied a lot of the condoms to a lot of the ladies who were West End prostitutes. So we knew most of them anyway. We don't know how much. See, this is the problem in. Some people did state that she'd earned about £30 that day, but she met up with 2 of her colleagues. I think it was Ruby Walker that she was talking to, who met her on the corner of Old Compton Street and Charing Cross Road. And this was 45 minutes before she was last seen alive. And she did say that she hadn't had a punter all night. She said, I haven't got off all night, meaning I haven't had a punter. Right, so she hadn't made any money. If the police are correct about the fact that she wouldn't prepare herself for sex until she got the money first, which is very likely, most prostitutes would do that. You wouldn't just
give up sex and then go, right, you owe me money. You would take the money first, and especially if the prostitute has a maid, she would slip the money to the maid. Therefore, the money is out of the room. Therefore, it's hidden. Therefore, if a robbery happens, not really a lot you can do, really. It's kind of the robbery is a bit of a tit. So it's likely that she would have been given money. If this was a man who wanted her for sex and then argued over it, maybe, as we saw with French Fifi, maybe argued with her about the money. Maybe she did receive a payment, £2 or £3, for whatever the sex was going to be. Maybe, as we've seen with the Greek guy, maybe there was a bit of an argument over it. Let's not forget that there's no one below her. That's the seamstress. That's closed. There's no one above her. There's no one on the first floor. That's where the seamstress is. There's no one on the ground floor, because that's where Fratelli's, the shop, is. That's shut. The only other people are three floors below in the basement, and they'd gone to bed. Neighbours either side didn't hear anything. Neighbours at the back didn't hear anything. So it could have been a guy going there to visit a prostitute, likely. And robbery wise, maybe she did take the money. She put it in her purse. That's why the purse is open. Maybe he took the money. Or maybe whoever went there to kill her took the money to make it look like a robbery, because given the fact that she's a prostitute, given the fact that she would have had money on her, that's the most likely suspect, isn't it? Why would anyone want to deliberately murder a prostitute, a kind of a random prostitute who doesn't seem to have any kind of big criminal connections or anything like that? Why would they want to kill her? Do you know? But if you did, easy way to make it look like it was just a random guy who's looking to have sex with prostitutes, got cheated out of money and then got angry, you steal her money. Or opportunist, you go to kill her, you see the money and you go, I'll have that. So clearly no signs of a break-in. A locksmith did turn up, as with the others. He said there was a Yale lock affixed to the street door and another on the flat door. Even though James Adams, who was the labourer who Stanley King had kind of said, hey, can you help me with this? Because he was a big guy. Stanley King was not particularly big. He was quite a slight man. He broke down the door. Even though the locksmith looked at the door, he said the lock itself was intact. It was James had kind of broken in the door. The wooden bit had broken, but he said everything prior to that looked like it was intact. So there hadn't been a prior break-in. Also, if there was a prior break-in, why would she undress and get herself ready for bed? So this is the thing. She's clearly... she either trusts the person she's with. She either knows them. It could be a client. Given the fact that it could be a stranger, but she would have spoken to him on the street. This is kind of the point where prostitutes assess men. As you've seen with her and the Greek man, they'd had a bit of a contretemps before. Good use of a word there. Bit of a contretemps, bit of a to-do prior. He tried to pick her up that night. She'd already argued with him prior about him kind of her asking for an amount and him giving her less. Although what it could be, as we've seen with French Fifi, that she may have agreed an amount and then later increased it. We're having to take one person's view as opposed to another. We should really take both. So where was I going with that? See, that's the problem. I'm by myself. I'm sitting by myself in my boat. I've got no one to turn around to and say, oh, whoa, where am I going with that? Greek guy. So, she's sat down with him. She's clearly assessed that this guy's okay. She's chatted to him as she walked along Old Compton Street. As far as we know, the two last witnesses, they didn't look at her and go, oh my God, there's Dutch Lair with a man. Oh my God, she's going to die. I must remember every single detail of this. It's they saw her with a man. It's like they probably saw her with a man hundreds of times before, thousands of times before. You know, they had no real reason to remember that moment. There wasn't a struggle going on. There wasn't any shouting. They just looked and they went, oh, look, there's... probably didn't even say, oh, look, there's Dutch Leia. They just saw her, as many other people had. So they did a pretty good job of remembering him. And their witness statements are pretty accurate. Even the police say, you know, reliable witnesses. They like them. They could see a direct correlation between what they were saying. But let's not forget, it was at night. It was dark. I think sunset was 8:40 p.m. that night. And this was 12:30 a.m. So well after night. It's not particularly good lighting on Old Compton Street. Most of the shops would have been shut. They weren't seen from a great distance, but they were seen from a distance enough, you know, 40, 50, 60 feet. So, and don't forget, you're not having to remember these people. There's not a reason to remember them. This is just, you saw someone you knew with someone you didn't know, but there's nothing suspicious about that. So, she clearly assessed the man. She clearly felt safe with him. The man was confirmed not to be Stanley King. In fact, at the inquest, it was asked of... I'm not going to say his name because it's one of the quiz questions. Of the man, they said, was it Stanley King? And they went, no. No, it definitely wasn't Stanley King. So Stanley King was ruled out of the inquest. That's the good thing about inquests is... Have a listen to New Blue. I think it's part 3 when I talk to Police Constable Arsenal Guinness about the difference between Crown Court and inquests. That's interesting, and that you can see why that's kind of, rather than going to the Old Bailey and watching cases, which can be really boring, it's more interesting to go to magistrates' courts or inquests. Inquests are really interesting. So the coroner has a chance to go through all the data and all the information and piece it all together and sit down and ask questions of the witnesses and the suspects as well. So clearly she turned up. She went into the room. She locked the door behind her. She took off both of her coats. She kept her shoes on. She rolled down her stockings. She was lying on the bed. She wasn't pushed on the bed. The bed hadn't been slept in. There was no movement on the bed. See, this is why it's weird. If it was Stanley King, were they preparing for sex? Or had he come home early? Because normally he comes... She said, be home by 2. But this was potentially half 12. Or, we don't know. See, we don't know. Maybe he came home. Door was open. Maybe he did have a key. We still don't know that. This is his whole alibi about not having a key and all that. It's very, very tenuous. Maybe he came home and saw her with a man. Maybe he came home and saw a man leaving. Maybe he came back and found evidence of a man in the flat, as he'd done before with the I'm going to phrase it properly, the Siemens discharge book and the raincoat. Maybe that was there. Maybe the man she was seen with that night, here's an idea, maybe he was the seaman. He was wearing a raincoat, and they do describe him as wearing a raincoat, but you know what? It's a lot of people wearing coats. It's hard. We don't have a description of the seaman, so we don't know. And we don't even know if he's real, because the only evidence we have of that is from Stanley. And it could be bollocks. So we don't know. This is where it all goes weird. There's a lot. This is the problem with... This is what I'm trying to do with the Soho Strangler cases. When you look at things like Jack the Ripper, because we don't have a lot of concrete evidence, a lot of people take the information from the newspapers and they use it as concrete fact. But when you start piecing things together, or even if you do have witness statements, unless you have corroborative witness statements, which give you a full overview, like with the two people who last saw Fifi alive, and we know what she was wearing because all the other people identified the fact that she was wearing like a blue spotted dress and you know, things like that. So we know all that. We know it was definitely her. That's why the police were kind of satisfied of her timeline, because she was wearing the blue spotted dress. I think it was black shoes, black stockings. She was wearing a little green hat at an angle slanted to the right. And everyone who saw her said, yeah, that's she was wearing this. So they was able to identify her exact movements.
which made it nice. And also that was the clothes she was murdered in as well, so it made it a lot simpler. And that wasn't reported in the press. That was only the people who saw her had that information, and they gave it to the police, which makes everything perfect. Oh, I can hear a horn outside. Oh, my life is exciting. She was clearly preparing herself for sex. I was about to say something, but that's a quiz question as well. Do you know what? When we do the Soho Strangler Week and we go through all the details, I won't have to worry about quiz questions. So we can just... I'm looking forward to really diving in, because there's a lot that we have not been able to put into this series. There's each episode is about 60 to 70 pages long in facts, just like tightly written facts, and then I have to boil it down to about 6 pages. There's a lot that doesn't go in, but that's why I'm looking forward to doing Soho Strangler Week. So if you want to take part of that, please do. That was it. Her clothes: a dark blue patterned polka dot dress, a light blue petticoat, and a green chemise, which is an undershirt. Also, she was wearing black gloves at the time, and a right-handed black glove was lying on the bed near her left foot, as was a piece of newspaper. We don't know what the newspaper was. She had two coats. They were lying on the settee, both believed to be hers. Something under the wardrobe. Same with Fifi. She'd rolled down her stockings herself, so they'd been unclipped. Same with Fifi, and then light rolled down. So that shows that it was her that had done it, and probably not her attacker. Because an attacker, as we said before, probably would have, if he wanted it as a weapon, probably would have ripped them off. But this is the interesting thing. Ooh, burpees. Why didn't he use her stocking to strangle her? If this was a Soho Strangler, and if these murders are connected, why didn't he use a stocking? Instead, he used a... black electrical flex, which we don't know where it comes from. Possibly it may have come from Stanley's magic bag. It may have been in the flat, because let's not forget the landlord left a couple of things behind, including the flat iron, which was one of the weapons that was used to murder her. He couldn't establish whether he had any black electrical flex in there, but he made them. Or the murderer may have brought it with him. We don't know. So, but why did he strangle her with something that either he wouldn't or couldn't tie in a knot at the end? It said it was looped, but it wasn't tied, so why? If stockings are clearly the easiest way to strangle someone, why would you use an electrical flex, which doesn't kind of work in the way you wanted to, and then you've got to beat her over the head with a flat iron? Doesn't make sense. Why not just use the stockings? They're partially rolled down. Doesn't make sense at all, anyway. Oh, it's so confusing. Anyway, I'm not going to go into the full details on this, because I've waffled a lot on this. I've waffled a lot into this more than I thought, but let's just get to the end. Blood splashes. So we know that she died in that exact spot. The bedsheet was pulled over her head. Her nose and mouth were kind of poking through. It was likely that she was punched first to render her unconscious, then manually strangled, then ligature strangulation, which kind of matches everything else that we've seen with the other cases before. And then he pulled out the flat iron and beat her over the head a couple of times. They couldn't actually say how many times she'd been hit over the head, but she was there was multiple fractures. Her head and face was caved in on the right hand side. We know that she hadn't moved, because there was no kind of disturbance to the bed in and around where there should be. So if there was a struggle, she should have had broken nails, which she didn't have. Same with Fifi, no broken nails. Same with Marie, no broken nails. There should have been evidence of kind of a struggle or assault. There wasn't. She was in that position. She'd barely moved. But when they were looking at the blood splashes from the repeated hits over her head with the flat iron, there was a little pear-shaped blood splashes, as mentioned, up the walls, on the ceiling, on the door behind. So... that was all in place, but when they moved the body, it was kind of, you know, everything was where it should have been. There was no clear sign that she'd moved or that she'd been out of place. So, yeah, it all happened very quickly. It all happened there. She was rendered unconscious. The strangulation, the beatings got her to the point where she was dead. She was dead. So, yeah, horrible, horrible way to die, and clearly still alive while being strangled and while being beaten over the head. What else is there? I think that's it. I don't want to go into too many details because we can enjoy that in leisurely for Soho Strangler Week, which I'm looking forward to. I'm going to map those out so they're more structured as opposed to just an extra mile waffle. Although knowing me, it'll probably be a bit waffle heavy. It'll be like a visit to Belgium, basically. Right, let's do the quiz questions. Oh, a slurp of tea. Lovely. And I've got a croissant left. I've eaten all my croissants and my chocolate donuts. I think I've got a pink donut. Pink donuts. Ugh. Anyway, question number one. Who was the first detective on the scene of Leia's murder? It was Divisional Detective Inspector Burt. Burt, feed me. Question number two. What was under Leia's wardrobe? It was her knickers. So that's the odd thing. They were described as wet and dirty. There's no real description of wet and dirty. Why? Whether she'd wet herself, whether she'd soiled herself. It could be possible because she was strangled. Or they may have just been wet and dirty anyway. We don't know who removed them. Maybe she removed them, or maybe the killer removed them, either before or afterwards. We don't know. So, question number three. What colour was Leia's bedspread? It was pink. Question number four. What weight was the flat iron? It was a kilo. So a flat iron is one of those kind of cast iron. They use them a lot kind of Victorian era, and this was before everyone had kind of you could afford to have electric irons. These would be the cast iron ones that you put on the hob, you heat it up, and when you're ironing your clothes, it's kind of a hot piece of iron, and you go shh. There you go. Question number five. Where was the inquest into Leia and Marie's murders held? It was at Westminster Coroner's Court. Question number six. Who oversaw it? It was the coroner, Mr. Ingleby Oddy. Question number seven. Who did the press... badly written this one. Who did the press say was the fourth victim of the Soho Strangler? It was a prostitute called Dorothy Raphael. I was going to do a section on this in the episode, but it just didn't fit there kind of rightly. I may use it later on. I probably won't. The idea was the end of May 1936, when everything's kind of dying down. This was the first time that they'd used the phrase the Soho Strangler. It was in that article. There's a picture of a lady called Dorothy Raphael, and they said new victim of the Soho Strangler, and it's Dorothy Raphael had grabbed her around the throat. She hadn't been killed, she hadn't been injured, nothing had really gone wrong. She screamed, the man ran away. Most likely, was it the Soho Strangler? No. We've seen with other prostitutes in this case and in other stories as well that, you know, the kind of arseholes who kind of treat prostitutes and women badly are the kind of arseholes who would punch them in the face and strangle them because they've got tiny cocks. There we go, that's that said. Question number eight. Who were the last witnesses to see Leia alive? There was Emilio Plantino and Nellie Few. Question number nine. Name one of the four victims of the supposed return of the Soho Strangler in the 1940s. That was Ginger Ray, episode 8 and 9. Russian Dora, on my list of possible cases to do, but there's not a lot out there. Margaret Cook. Margaret Cook, who is episode 13, and Black Rita, who I'm... it's one of these cases where it's still held today.
there's a lot of kind of suspicion in it. There's a lot of kind of accusation. So it's one of those cases where I keep putting forward my Freedom of Information requests and it keeps getting rejected. There's one that an episode I'm desperate to do now, and it's normally they try and get back to you within about a month to say whether they can release it or not. This one has taken 8 months now. So we'll get there. Black Rita is one that I'm fighting for, but we don't know. Which is why I haven't done the Return of the Soho Strangler. But maybe I might do. And question number 10. What is the name of the press's very possible suspect? It was the last words I said in the episode. Mr. Cohen. Mr. Cohen. Well, did you think he was going to come back? As mentioned in episodes 3 and 4. Or do you think it was just a myth? Well, we will be diving in to Mr. Cohen in episode 7. Oh, this is exciting. This is where it gets really crazy and really interesting. And hopefully, if you're one of the people who came on my original tours, we did the Soho Strangler on the tours, but it was only kind of a brief overview and a bit of a press-centric angle on it. So we didn't get to dive into it in anywhere near as much detail as this, but this is kind of as full as we can make it. And we did, in the episode, in the tours, we did cover Mr. Cohen. Oh, exciting. So I think that's me done. Yeah, I've waffled on far too long. So that's me done. I'm going to wrap this up. I'm going to go and visit my mate down the pub. I'm going to go to another pub. I've got to go all the way to Forest Gate, and there's only night buses. So I have to do a night bus from Forest Gate. Fuck's sake. Best take my stab vest. Anyway, that's me done. Hope you've all enjoyed that. And I will look forward to hearing from you in episode 7. Why would I hear from you in episode 7? No idea why I just said that. Have yourselves a good week, folks. Stay safe and be good. Lots of love. But
tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Listen to this Acast show ad-free on Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.